We're doing the Drashot Aran. We're up to page Kuftet Zayin in the Machon Shalem edition, Reish Samech Hey, in the Mosad Rav Kook edition. And the Aran had been discussing the rabbinic institutions, and the Aran said the prime sahar, the prime wages, is where the rabbis instituted fences to protect us from transgressing the laws of the Torah. And once the rabbis make such an institution, so then we get great wages, because this is an act that we're doing to take greater care to ensure we don't transgress what God himself said. So you have the things God said, and then you have the things where we take an extra step. God says don't write on Shabbos, we don't touch a pen on Shabbos. So the Ran says you get great wages for that, because that shows you're taking that extra step to ensure you're going to do what God says. So you'll ask me, but we have a rule, Gadolam Tzuveh Ve'oseh. It's greater when you do what you're told than when you voluntarily do something. Right? That's the rule we have. That it's always harder to do it when you're told to do it. And the Talmud tells us that it's considered greater to do it when you're told than to volunteer to do it. So the Talmud tells us in Kiddushin, the story of Dama ben Nesina, who wouldn't wake his father even when he risked losing a lot of money. So then the Talmud says, you see, he wasn't even commanded. Look how far he went in his Kibbut Aveim. So if we're commanded, how much more so? So that seems to indicate the opposite of what he said a minute ago. So he says, okay, so I have three claims on this. If you'd come to me with that question, I have three answers, and now we're going to begin. Ha'achat, the first claim, Shemina yadua ki kigodel atzar asher yegiyenu bavodato yegdal tzchareinu. If we have to gauge how much wages we're going to get, so we already discussed our different ways of gauging what a mitzvah is worth. There's the idea of what did the mitzvah accomplish? Maybe it wasn't difficult for you, but you gave someone penicillin. You had extra penicillin in your pocket, and he needed it. You saved his life. So the accomplishment is great, even though the investment might be little. So that's one way of gauging a mitzvah. What did the mitzvah actually accomplish? Another way of gauging the mitzvah is, how difficult was it for you to do it? It might not have been easy. So then the harder you had to work to accomplish the mitzvah, he says, we know that the harder, the more work you had to put in, the more wages you're going to get for it. That's what the Mishnah says. The harder the work, the more the wages. Yeah.
So, something's very difficult. I know I'm going to get better wages in heaven for it. Why can't I? It's to stop me from making things more difficult for myself so I can get a bigger blessing.
What would you do if you had a son who did that? You ask your son to take out the garbage, and he says, let me put in a few bricks. He says, can I tie one hand behind my back when I do that? I just want to make it harder. If I tie my feet and do it.
But it sounds very much like a game, so why not just go along with it? If he's saying you do something a lot really hard, then you're going to get a better mitzvah. But if you do it a little less, you're going to get more. It has all the makings of a game. And so if you make it a little different, a little difficult for yourself. And I would be like, oh my gosh, he's like really thinking about what I said. He's putting a lot of intellectual work into this. And he's working hard, and now he wants to make something harder on himself so he can remember that he's really doing it for me, and he's really trying to get as much out of it as he possibly can. Maybe he even should get more than a natural occurring difficult mitzvah.
Okay, so I think that that's if we make the difficulty a goal. Meaning you're making it an end and not a means. You're saying we want to do something difficult. And what he's saying is, you want to do what's right. And if it's difficult, then obviously you deserve more wages for doing it.
Just the whole system of reward, it seems a little bit strange.
So again, this is a tangent, but I think that the easiest way to understand it is like the Chassam Sofer writes, that technically you're right. There's no reason to get reward for doing what's right. Doing what's right is like stopping by a red light. That's what's expected of you. No one expects to get rewarded for it. It's a gift. And once you view it that way, so then the gift can work based on a system.
But the only reason why you shouldn't get rewarded for something is if it isn't in your nature to do it. Like, if God had commanded you to do something, then, and it isn't your nature to do something, right, you should get rewarded for it because it isn't something part of your nature. But if you have innately inside of you the will to do good things, it seems like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't get rewarded for it.
Very good. This is almost identical to what the Chassam Sofer writes, what you're saying now. He takes it from a slightly different angle, and that's why he says he thinks that we should say that you don't have to get rewarded. It's a gift. That's what we just said. I'm saying it is along the lines you're saying. He works it out philosophically a little differently.
So is he saying then that we don't have this ability to do good without having told to us by God?
That's another concept.
Well, no, because if it all ties in with the reward and punishment system. Because, like I said, if you shouldn't get rewarded for it, if it's something that you feel, you know, naturally. You said you shouldn't have to be told what to do. It's something, right? You shouldn't be rewarded for something that is good because everyone knows you should do that. But God, we are apparently without this good innate status, and we have to be told specifically what to do. That's the whole reason for. Right and wrong, of course. How would we know the difference between right and wrong unless God told us?
So even if you say that, whether it's innate or not innate, if it's considered the basic requirements of living in this world, so just like you could say it's not innate for me to stop at a red light, but once I do it, I don't necessarily deserve a reward for it. So the direction the Chassam Sofer takes it is that you were given a system which is the basic way you should live in this world. And you don't deserve a reward for it. It's out of his kindness that he chooses to reward you for it. But it's not because keeping the Torah and mitzvos is like running into a burning building and saving someone at a great cost or danger to yourself. Keeping Torah and mitzvos is basic. And really you don't deserve a reward for it. You're doing the basic thing you should be doing here. It might not be innate for you. It might even be difficult for you. So what? So for another guy, it's difficult to stop at a red light. The Chassam Sofer, he says the following question. He says, I can view the Torah and mitzvos like something extraordinary, like running into a burning building, and then I understand why you get rewarded for doing it, but then don't punish a person who doesn't do it. I can understand that doing the Torah and mitzvos is like stopping by a red light, so I understand why you punish someone who doesn't do it, but then why give rewards to someone who does do it? It's not, you know, that's what you got to do. It's the basic. So which way is it? So then the Chassam Sofer says that the Torah mitzvos is like stopping by a red light. God says, that's basic. That's how you got to live in this world. It is innate. It isn't innate. You like it. You don't like it. It's hard. It's easy. That has nothing to do with it. That's the system that God says is expected from every Jew.
Yeah, and I understand the reason why we're stopping by a red light is because we doubt there's a very good chance that we're going to have a very bad collision and it would be a great risk for our lives if we went with the red light going. But in this case, this is just, you know, general right and wrong. And it's the only way that you can gauge whether it's right or wrong is by the well-being of the person. And there's many alternatives. It isn't just as easy as going by straight, by red light, maybe crashing, not crashing. Sometimes there's many, different decisions that you can make that would all be good. Some of them might be better or worse, depending on the situation. It's very hard to say that you would, to me, to understand why you would get, how the reward and punishment system would work with that many complications. And then sometimes, I'm not sure that's a very good analogy, the red line. But,
I think you're nitpicking on the analogy, when the analogy was just a way of saying, is it something basic we expect of someone? I gave the analogy just to demonstrate, but the question is it a basic expectation?
Well, like a doctor, if someone's able to be a doctor, it's expected of them to help people. He still needs to make a salary, right? Like he's going to get rewarded for it. Like it's something that he's trained to do. He's got the ability, and it's just like, whatever, like he does it every day. It's almost like second nature to him. But
then
we say that because it's so simple for him nowadays that he doesn't deserve a reward for it?
Yeah.
Doesn't that argue, I mean, Dubna talk about this at the beginning of his book, that like we, because we're descendants of Avraham Avinu, and like it's built into us since they did do all these moral things, but God gave us the mitzvot so we could get reward? Like it would have
been, I don't remember it.
And then, but now that we got this commandment, then it, ironically, it kind of, now we don't, we have a problem doing it because now we're.
All right.
But God wanted to do it, give us the commandment, so we'd get reward for it, so we'd get a payment for it.
I guess what I was trying to say is that it doesn't seem moral to make a game out of it, to say that you're going to get a reward for doing good things. It shouldn't be what you're looking for when you're doing a mitzvah is to get a reward.
Agreed.
Mitzvah is a misnomer, I think, if to call something a mitzvah. It's something you should do. It isn't a mitzvah. It should be the way things work in order for everything to work in harmony. For people to live, and to do good things for each other. A society can't flourish without people doing good things for each other, to make sure that everyone's health, then you could reciprocate, and you could get good things back from these people, and then you do well, they do well.
So that's good for Noahide. But we were given mitzvot.
It's all derived from the basic tenets of morality, and then you get to specifics. But, it all depends. It's like... for medicine, for example, there isn't anyone who's debating that someone who's throwing up and having these, terrible problems, that they're not sick. Some people could say, I suppose the person would like to throw up and they wouldn't feel very good. That depends on it. Most people would, there's no disagreement that that is clearly wrong. And they would like to feel, the well-being of the person. A definition of a well person would be someone who's not right, who's not showing these signs of sicknesses, illnesses. So when they're healthy, I think we can agree that they're healthy. Same thing should be with doing right and wrong, I think. You should. It seems like the very basic things, doing good for someone else, shouldn't need mitzvahs to make you see that this is really good, I'm getting rewarded for it, and this is defining what's good for me. It's just something that you should be able to detect, I think. I was talking to Rav Cohen the other day, and I asked him, I said, if you see someone roasting a car in the middle of the street, what would you do? Would you stop and you'd think, which tractate tells me that I should run and help that person? And what commentary describes that? You wouldn't do that. I said, suppose you're too young, you didn't have time, you don't know how to read yet, you don't know how... To reference these things. What would you do? Honestly, what would be your...
Why don't you look at Gaza? This week you had a very nice showing of what human beings do. Innocent civilians were killed and they gave out candies. Or why don't you look at Gaza when two children were taken and their blood was used for paint all over a cave wall, and in Gaza they gave out sweets to the children.
These people that you're talking about, they're not average... They're people who have a very distorted view of reality. They believe that they're doing everything for the glory of God, and God's going to reward them with virgins, and they're going to have, or grapes, as some people say.
But the kids, you just said, the kids who didn't learn all these tractates.
Yes, but all around, they're brainwashed from being very young, and it's...
So you understand it could go both ways, though. They'll look at you and say, you're brainwashed with Western culture.
Well, you could say that, but... I don't have a whole philosophy that's timeless. I don't have a distorted view of it. It's like for someone to have they have an alternate. Oh, I already said it. They have an alternate view of reality. They don't have a they when they look at the world, their worldview is one that that points to the afterlife or.
And when they'd crucify Jews in the center of town and bring in all the children to watch it.
Who are you talking
about? I'm talking about many times throughout the ages in France and in Spain and all the people who were so sophisticated or the Germans or the Poles or the British or the Russians. I'm saying world history doesn't exactly back what you're saying.
There's reason. These things don't just happen because of human nature. So you're condemning what we are. You can't do that because it isn't, we don't, it's not like a religion that you're condemning here where you can blame one philosophy. There's many separate reasons for it. You're talking about Lenin, for example, This man was a demagogue and he made a religion out of
it. But he had people who were killing for him. He didn't kill the millions.
I think it's safe to say he killed millions. The philosophy that he developed was responsible for the killing of millions. There's who was it that said, someone who you can make believe, I'm trying to think of the exact word. When you believe like incredible nonsense, this isn't the right word, but he said incredible nonsense, they can also make you commit terrible atrocities also.
Okay, to be continued. I think the rest of the class isn't with us, so we got to get back to the run. And but to be continued. I'm not just saying that. We have to find the time to continue.
The whole idea of being rewarded for the mitzvah, it seems to throw an extra complication. Like, why do you need something to, like a carrot waving in front of your face to go in the right direction?
Let's see. Maybe I'll address that as we continue. I think it is important. I think in life it is important. And we'll see as we go on. Yeah?
I was going to say, I know anthropologists who lived in the tribe of Papua New Guinea, where they're very violent, and to teach their kids to fight, and they would take the bodies of the enemies and half them in front of the kids. And the kids would always flinch. The kids wouldn't respond to it, like, oh, okay, so this is what I see my dad doing, and so... Okay, I just take it naturally. And they've always kind of, when I was talking with them, they're kind of like, yeah, we noticed this, that our kids flinch, and so we kind of have to teach them that, it's societal pressure, it's the influence of society saving these kids. So the kids naturally were repulsed by that, and then, but, they got used to it, because the society taught them that it was okay.
Okay.
I'm not sure science would bear you out about getting used to it. Because why are they doing it in the first place? The reason why they're doing it is because it's so terribly wrong that they start to derive pleasure out of this incredible, disgusting act that they're doing by killing another person. It's like they're feeding off of it. It's like a twisted view of reality once your mind starts to get used to a certain way of thinking. But I don't think you ever forget that it's wrong inside of us. We have a very approximate language.
I think
it's very hard to discuss these things.
Huh? I think I would tie a shear on this whole idea of giving a reward. I can't remember if it was in the Chavat HaMinim or in the Rambam thing that was talking about giving a reward every time they do it. Like from a child, getting a nut or whatever, up to someone that's not even a rab that's studying just to become a dayan.
Yeah, okay. Let's go back to the Ran. There's a lot to discuss, but let's hear the Ran. So he says, I have three claims, if you'll come and ask me, Gadolam Tzuveh Mimishe Nomo Tzuveh Voseh, and then you have the story of Dama Ben Nesina, where you seem to say, if he wasn't commanded and he did it, how much more so we should. So, number one, the more difficult our work, the more, the greater the wages. As our sages said, the more difficult, the more wages. It's known. That if you weren't commanded to do something, so then you don't have that inclination not to do it, because no one told you to do it. As someone who was commanded feels the inclination, I don't want to do it. You're about to volunteer to take out the garbage, and then your mother said, could you please take out the garbage? And suddenly you say, well, I just got to take care of something. Suddenly it's much harder. Once we're told to do something, it's harder for us to do it. We feel like we're losing our autonomy. And based on this approach, the Talmud tells us in Tractate Yuma, they used to send out a man with a goat on Yom Kippur to push it off the cliff, right? So the Talmud tells us an important concept. There was a distance of 90 ris from Jerusalem to the cliff. And as this old man would take the goat to the cliff, every time he'd have a hut every 7.5 ris, He'd come to a hut where they'd offer him bread and water. It's Yom Kippur. But they tell him, if you need to break your fast, here's the bread and here's the water. And they'd do that to quell his desires. As the Talmud says, Tana me'olam lo nitzrach adam nekach. Our tradition is that no man ever broke his fast. All the years, the rabbi set it up so that he gets 10 offers along the way to the cliff. He has 10 offers. Would you like some bread? You want some water? We have it here ready for you. And he never took them up on it. So then why'd they do it? You can't compare someone who has bread in his basket to someone who doesn't. When you don't have bread in your basket, you're all the more hungry. When you have it in your basket, you're less hungry. The fact that you know you could have it at any time makes you less hungry. So again, he's using this to explain the idea that when you're commanded, so then it's as though you don't have the bread in the basket. They told me to do this. I cannot do different. When I feel that I could do different, then it's easier for me to do this. In Eisha Torah, they have a class where if you want to enter the class, you have to sign that you will not become observant. You have to sign a contract that for 3 months after the class, you will not observe Torah and mitzvahs. Then you can enter the class, because the class is going to discuss philosophy. And if you feel that now, if I buy into this, then I... tomorrow morning, no eating pork. So then you ain't going to buy into it, right? You'll do everything to fight. So they say, okay, take that pressure off. For 3 months, you're not allowed to become observant. Now let's talk. Does it make sense or doesn't it make sense? We're all that way. When you feel like you have every option in front of you, it's easier to choose the right one. When you feel like I have no choice, they're putting a gun to my head, so then all you want to do is break free. That's why our sages taught that if someone is commanded to do a mitzvah, and then it's harder. His natural human desires are pushing the other way, and he overcomes that. So that's why he gets greater wages. He gets greater wages than someone who wasn't commanded, and he happened upon the mitzvah and did it. Because he always had the option of saying no. No one told them to do it. אבל מה שיסכימו עליו חכמי ישראל ינישב אצלנו ואצלם אחר הסכמתם כמצוות המפורשות בתורה ושבנו אנו מצווים ועושים. So he says, but when the sages told me to do something, so then I no longer have the other option. I said for rabbinic mitzvot, says the Ran. I told you for rabbinic mitzvot, you get greater wages. You'll tell me, but... we have a rule that you get greater wages when you're commanded. Well, you are commanded to listen to the rabbis. So that's not a reason you should get less wages for rabbinic mitzvah, because we just said earlier in this speech that when the rabbis said it, you have to listen. So if you have to listen, so then I'm also mitzuveh vosan rabbinic mitzvot. And I would add another idea, that rabbinic mitzvot, it's harder to listen to. It's easier for me to listen to God than to the rabbi. God, I understand. He said, I'll listen. The rabbi, why should I listen to him? What does he know anyways? He made an institution. That's why the rabbis, when they'd make an institution, they'd have a ban. They'd have a rule that they don't give the reasoning behind the institution for the first period after making the institution. Because if people would understand the logic behind it, then everyone would have a reason not to obey. Everyone could give you a good reason why I could do better. The rabbi said, yeah, but I think different. So if that's going to be the reasoning that mitzuvevo says versus enom mitzuvevo says, so the Ran says, well, on rabbinic mitzvot, we're also mitzuvevo says. We're obligated to do it. So that's not a claim against me when I say the great wages are for the observance of the rabbinic mitzvot that protect us from transgressing the Torah, because in that too, we are mitzuvevo says. We are obligated to do it.